Iowa's role in the 2016 presidential race has been one of the top news stories of our state this year. But what other Iowa news stands out in 2015? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today I talk with Iowa Public Radio correspondents and reporters about the Iowa news year that was, including the bird flu epidemic, the privatization of Medicaid, the Bakken pipeline controversy, the Iowa Supreme Court's ruling on telemedicine abortion, as well as that brouhaha over the hiring of Bruce Harreld as the new University of Iowa president. That and plenty more as we review some of the top Iowa news stories of 2015. First, this news from NPR. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The 2016 presidential race has dominated much of the news in Iowa this year, but it was a very busy news year otherwise as well. This hour, we'll be chatting with Iowa Public Radio reporters and correspondents about some of the other top Iowa news they've covered, including the bird flu epidemic, the Bakken pipeline controversy, that Supreme Court ruling on telemedicine abortion, as well as the big brouhaha over the hiring of Bruce Harreld as the new University of Iowa president, to name a few. Later in the hour, we'll hear about those. First of all, let's start off with some stories that Clay Masters has been covering. Clay Masters, Iowa Public Radio Morning Edition host and reporter. Hi, Clay.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Good afternoon to you. Let's start off with what is still a controversy. Governor Terry Branstad moving ahead with a plan to put private companies in charge of managing Medicaid services, a program that impacts a lot of Iowans, over 500,000 poor and disabled Iowans who receive health care under this huge program, $4 billion program. What was the governor's reason for putting the management in private hands now?
Now, this is coming from a guy, Clay Masters right here, who covers a lot of Iowa caucus activity, but I would argue that this is the most important Iowa-specific story this year. But, you know, Ben, it's also probably the hardest to follow story this year. So whenever we talk about it, it's good to start kind of from ground zero. Mm-hmm. So it covers 560,000 Iowans, as you mentioned, and it was announced back in January that the governor was interested in doing this. It didn't require legislative approval, and the governor said it would save some $51 million. And certainly I'm not the only one who's been covering this here at the station. Both IPR's Sarah Bowden and Joyce Russell have done a lot of extensive coverage on this as well. So back in August, what I tried to do was humanize it just ahead of when the winning bidders were going to be announced. And what people are most concerned about, those that are on Medicaid, as you mentioned, a very vulnerable population. We're talking about lots of Iowans, disabled, poor, low-income families, even people on private insurance. Many times they can't get insurance for maybe a child because they won't cover this vulnerable population. So they're concerned that their care will be overlooked in favor of companies making a profit. So what the Department of Human Services argues is that what this does is creates some one-stop shopping for those enrolled in Medicaid. So maybe you have five different doctors and it's hard for them to communicate. This offers an ability for them to work together. And then by doing this, it saves the state money.
Mm-hmm. Last week, of course, we heard that federal administrators have ordered Iowa to wait at least 60 days before shifting its Medicaid program to private management. So that puts it off into March. I guess this is a story that carries over into 2016 for sure.
For sure. And the four private companies that won the bid were Amerigroup Iowa, AmeriHealth Caritas Iowa, and United Healthcare Plan of the River Valley, and then also WellCare of Iowa. The Des Moines Register investigative reporter Jason Clayworth did a great job uncovering that some of these winning bidders had a history of some fraud. And WellCare, actually, it was announced on Friday that they've been terminated. So this multimillion-dollar contract with one of the companies selected to run this privately managed Medicaid program, again, been terminated. So as you mentioned, state Senate Democrats went to Washington to meet with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. about a month ago, kind of basically to say, slow this thing down. And that's what CMS has done. That's the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. And it, as you mentioned, was January 1st when this was going to be implemented. Now they're saying March 1st. But the Democrats are saying that this was great to call for postponing it so these problems, these significant concerns can be addressed and looked at. And then the governor, our Republican governor, Terry Branstad, says, hey, we've got the green light. And you know what? We're going to be ready by March 1st. So this is something that will carry on past the caucuses, if you can imagine such a thing.
Clay Masters, another story that has its roots way back in the beginning of 2015, is the what you reported on, how the board of the state's largest water utility voted unanimously to sue three northern Iowa counties, holding them responsible for high nitrate levels in rivers that this utility uses for source water for the Des Moines area. Explain more of the reasoning behind this court action.
Well, yeah, this is something that's been mounting for some time, and it's something that I've covered since I got here in 2012. It's this argument that takes place in the state over voluntary compliance versus involuntary compliance, and we're talking about environmental issues. So what we're really putting our finger on is industrialized large agriculture. You have organizations like the Farm Bureau, the different interest groups like the Iowa Corn Growers, the typical big agriculture organizations that you think of when you think about large industrialized agriculture, who are saying that it's easier for to not have as much regulation on farmers to try to control the nitrates that are leaving their farms. And when we talk about nitrates, this is essentially a pollution. And a lot of this water is being – a lot of these nitrates are being funneled to the rivers in the states – and it's has to be the water has to be treated
right.
before it can be shipped out. Go ahead.
Right, and I have an interview you did, a little clip from an interview you did with Des Moines Water Works CEO and General Manager Bill Stowe, going into in depth the reason why they're bringing this lawsuit.
Fortunately, in a context where there's a lot of discussion about voluntarism and conservation practices that will take flight voluntarily by farmers learning more about it, we're still seeing the public water supply in central Iowa directly risked by high nitrate concentrations. And we've come to a point in the history of Des Moines Water Works where we've been very cooperative with farm groups, commodity groups. We began when I came to really confront through the media the egg producers and their contribution to water pollution in Iowa. And frankly, neither of those approaches got us where we need to be, and that's protecting on behalf of our consumers the water quality in both the Des Moines and Raccoon River. So after a great deal of discussion and realistically data collection for the entire year of 2014, we've been in northern Iowa with our lab personnel testing water that's discharged from drainage districts in largely in Sac County, and found that they are significant polluters to the Raccoon River. From that, in our discussions with the board, the decision was made last night to move forward with providing a notice of intent to sue, with the hope that the counties and the state of Iowa, the Department of Natural Resources in particular, will step forward with a very principled way to move us toward water quality. If they're unsuccessful in doing that, then we'll move forward with a lawsuit in federal court.
Bill Stowe of Des Moines Water Works announcing that intent to sue. So that was many months ago. Where is the lawsuit now, Clay?
Well, it's still awaiting a trial date, which looks to be sometime looking like late winter, early spring. And you play a clip from Des Moines Water Works CEO Bill Stowe there. Interesting, too, what we've seen in this year, what's called the Iowa Partnership for Clean Water has been running attack ads against Bill Stowe and the Des Moines Water Works. It's a partnership from the Iowa Farm Bureau, and they're targeting him, saying that this is political, that they're playing politics. And, you know, what they are really advocating for is for large-scale farms to be able to put in some environmental practices like cover crops, buffer strips, wetlands to try to reduce this nitrates. But the Des Moines Water Works says, you know, this is unfair when they have a lot of regulations on them and non-point polluters are not having those regulations put on them.
Clay Masters with me looking back at some of the top stories that he's covered this year. We'll be going on to other Iowa Public Radio correspondents and reporters in just a few moments. Well, Clay, 2015 was freshman U.S. Senator Joni Ernst's first year in office. Ernst, the first woman ever elected to represent Iowa in Washington. She's very much seen as a rising star in the Republican Party, so much so that she was asked to give a response to the president's State of the Union speech. Here's a little bit of what she used in that speech, which was pulled from her campaign speech, actually, redone that way.
We were raised to live simply, not to waste. It was a lesson my mother taught me every rainy morning. You see, growing up, I had only one good pair of shoes. So on rainy school days, my mom would slip plastic bread bags over them to keep them dry. But I was never embarrassed, because the school bus would be filled with rows and rows of young Iowans with bread bags slipped over their feet.
Okay, Joni Ernst there in the State of the Union address, broadcast nationwide, certainly seen as a rising star in the Republican Party. What do you have to say about her first year in office?
Well, first I'd have to say that I'm just amazed that the bread bag shoes didn't just take off, that we're not still seeing people in December wearing bread bags on shoes. But no, we started the year with that rebuttal for the State of the Union. And let's recall the election, the messages that we heard all through the 2014 Senate race. You know, she grew up castrating pigs on an Iowa farm, so when she got to Washington, she'll know how to cut pork. She saved for college by working in the morning at the Hardee's making biscuits. She was a National Guard lieutenant who strongly supported the Second Amendment and drives a Harley. So, you know, what she did in her first year in the Senate, you know, she offered a bill to strengthen veterans' mental health care by making it easier to get help outside the Department of Veterans Affairs. That legislation is still up in the air at this point. Her office also points to something they see as a good thing, as a resolution of the disapproval to scrap the expanded Waters of the U.S. rule that was passed in the Senate and now heading to the U.S. House of Representatives. Also, a big controversial topic that she spearheaded in the Senate was leading this effort to defund Planned Parenthood. Now, this was following those controversial and doctored videos that hinted towards Planned Parenthood selling the body parts of babies. And also of note, too, Planned Parenthood spent hundreds of thousands of dollars in attack ads against her in 2014 in that election against former Congressman and Democrat Bruce Braley. And then also another kind of side note here, political-wise, she inserted herself into the presidential race back in this summer by hosting that inaugural Roast and Ride. I don't know if you remember that fundraiser.
Oh, yes. I remember the picture we have on our website still of her. Was it riding along Scott Walker?
Yeah, that's right. So, yeah, and you bring up Scott Walker, and, you know, there was barbecue, candidates could ride motorcycles, and the two candidates that the press was really swarming around back then were these guys named Rick Perry and Scott Walker, the governors
of— Who are they?
Yeah, exactly. The former governor of Texas and the governor of Wisconsin. They were the only two candidates that actually drove motorcycles, and they were the first two candidates to drop out of the race. So I don't know if those motorcycles doomed those campaigns.
Well, I don't know if we'll have to see if it's a perpetuating omen for future Roast and Rides for Joni Ernst.
Exactly.
So looking forward, you met with her recently, I understand, Senator Ernst. To her legislative priorities going forward?
Well, we'll kind of have to wait and see. You know, this was her first year, and it was really about these different issues that she was pushing forward in her first year in the Senate. And, you know, with the Senate still in control by Republicans, it is kind of amazing to see that a senator from Iowa who was in the minority Senate party here is now in the majority for the United States Senate. So she continues to be a star within the party in her inaugural year, and we're just going to have to wait and see.
Okay, Clay Masters, you're allowed to jump on your Harley and exit the studio.
Okay.
if you like.
I left vroom, it. Vroom, I left vroom. It. Yeah, I forgot it. Thanks, Ben.
Clay Masters, Iowa Public Radio Morning Edition host, reporter. Catching us up on some of the big stories he's been covering this year. That's what we're doing this hour, looking back at Iowa news, not caucus-specific news with Iowa Public Radio reporters and correspondents. Joining me now, Joyce Russell, on the eve of the 2016 legislative session. We want to, Joyce, look back at what lawmakers accomplished and also what they left on the table in the 2015 session. Hello.
Hello, Ben.
So for you, what were some of the biggest items that passed through the legislature this past year?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that the gas tax increase certainly has to be, if not the top story, one of the top stories. Of course, it affects every motorist in the state. As you know, it got through both chambers with some arm twisting early in the session, so they really wrapped this up early.
And that was a surprise, wasn't it? It had been years this has been haggled over and say, we need that money for infrastructure. And then all of a sudden, boom, at the beginning of the session, it goes through.
Well, it was clear that they were likely to have the consensus on it this year. And so the strategy was to get it done early in the session because there was still going to be some heavy lobbying on both sides. And they didn't want it to get mixed up in the passions of closing down the session. One lobbyist on the issue said it's harder for lawmakers to play nice towards the end of the session. So that was part of their strategy, and it was wise given what a hard time the legislature had closing up shop this year.
What else do you look to as highlights that passed through the legislature?
Well, I think the school start date fight finally being resolved this year was one of the most significant things that happened, as you know, there for years the tourism industry had tried to change Iowa law so that schools couldn't keep starting earlier and earlier in August, and the state fair was one of the main complainants there. So they finally changed that so that you can't start classes earlier than August 23rd, and that started with this school year.
Mm-hmm. Of course, in education, Branstad, the governor, vetoing millions of dollars in state spending that the legislature approved, cutting education spending for K-12 schools, community colleges, Regents universities. What was behind that story?
Well, it was sort of a typical partisan fight over education spending, with Democrats wanting to spend more than Republicans. And their 110-day session lasted 145 days as they tried to come up with a compromise on this education funding. And as you know, the compromise involved $50 million for schools that was supposed to be for so-called one-time funding. They could use it for a number of things, but they couldn't build it into their budget so that next year's budget would be built on that extra $50 million. And as you know, they finally came to a bipartisan agreement on that, and then the governor vetoed it. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of bodes poorly, I think, for the upcoming session as far as just kind of psychologically the sort of trust factor there.
Another controversial aspect of the governor's work this year, he shuttered two of four of the state's mental health hospitals. Opposition there. Branstad wanting to shut them. Why?
Well, he argued that they were outdated, that they lacked enough psychiatrists to staff them, and that community services would be a better way to serve these patients. Now, the institutions themselves and their advocates vigorously disputed that argument. You have to realize that this follows the closing of the juvenile home in Toledo a year ago. So the state's public employees union, as well as advocates for patients, sharply opposed both of those closings. They questioned the quality and availability of services elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Any repercussions there carrying on into 2016?
Well, there's still a lawsuit. The state's public employees union filed a lawsuit along with a number of Democratic state senators. Their argument is that it's part of Iowa law that there are these four institutions, and that the governor that was illegal for the governor to, in effect, shut them down. A district court ruled with the governor on that, but I just spoke this morning with the head of the public employees union, and he said an appeal of that is in the works.
A couple more items before we go to break. With you, Joyce, this year, heated conversation about whether the state should allow a new oil pipeline across the state. This would be a pipeline carrying crude oil from the so-called Bakken oil fields in North Dakota to Iowa, across Iowa. a decision expected early next year about whether the Iowa Utilities Board will grant the company the wanting to build the pipeline a permit, and whether the board will grant the company eminent domain powers. We saw here, and you covered it, Joyce, hundreds of people showing up to informational meetings about the pipeline this year. Give us a sense of what the sides are, what the concerns are.
Well, I attended that. The story you're referring to was the first of these county meetings. They had public hearings in this pipeline would crisscross the state, as you know, and cross through 33 counties. So they were required to have a hearing in every one of those counties. The first one, starting in southeast Iowa, was in Mount Pleasant, and they had an overflow crowd there. One of the people that I talked to there that day said, this crowd is so big, I don't know if they're going to have a venue big enough to cover this in some of the other counties. But at any rate, it's a landowner's rights issue for some of these landowners. And also there are concerns about damage, soil and water damage, if anything should go wrong with the pipeline. The critics of this say it's not a question of if it will leak, it's a question of when it will leak.
Mm-hmm. And this is an interesting issue where we have landowners siding also with environmentalists on the same side of the controversy.
Yes, in some cases, but then there are other environmentalists who would say that it's safer to transport oil underground than to transport it by rail. And that's backed up by a number of serious accidents with crude oil being hauled by rail.
Mm-hmm. Decision, as I mentioned, expected early in 2016. Do we have any sense of how the Iowa Utilities Board will rule in this case? I know reporting that the company making the pipeline has been stacking a heck of a lot of pipeline, I think, over by Newton.
Yeah, so it's clear that what they think the outcome is going to be. But it's a complex decision. The board has been – they had a series of public hearings, and then now the parties will file briefs in the case. Those might not be in until after Christmas. So initially – it's always been a moving target, and initially they said December or January for a decision, and now they're saying it could be February before they finally make a ruling on it.
And finally, Joyce, citing security in the wake of the Paris terrorist attacks on November 13th, Governor Branstad became one of 30 governors nationwide who want to block Syrian resettlement, Syrian refugees in the states. Here is a little bit of what he had to say after the Paris attacks.
I remember he called me and said he learned two things about Iowa.
Wrong cut.
You need to love Jesus.
Okay. We got a little bit of wrong audio there.
Yeah.
So the governor is saying here that I guess the question here is governors, this governor or the other 29 governors, do they really have the power to block refugees from coming into Iowa or any other state?
They don't. And the day that the governor was speaking about this at his Monday morning news conference, he stressed that he said he had serious security concerns about terrorists entering the country as refugees, but that state governments don't have the authority to block them. Then as that day progressed, there was one Republican governor after another saying, we're going to block the refugees, we're going to block the refugees. So by the end of the day, the governor put out a strongly worded statement, but a more nuanced one that said an executive ordering all state agencies to cease any preparations they're making for the resettlement of refugees.
Also a story we'll watch in 2016. Joyce, thank you very much. We've run out of time.
Okay.
Interestingly, evangelical Christians, as well as Christians more broadly, a core group in the Republican electoral base and among the most passionate advocates for aiding refugees. We'll definitely watch that in 2016. Joyce Russell joining us. When we come back, we'll talk about the bird flu epidemic, the brouhaha over the hiring of Bruce Harreld as well. River to River from Iowa Public Radio News this hour, looking back at some of the Iowa news with Iowa Public Radio reporters and correspondents. I'm Ben Kiefer, back with more of River to River in just a moment. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're looking back at the Iowa news this year with Iowa Public Radio reporters and correspondents. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll talk with Dean Borg about the controversy over the hiring of the new University of Iowa president, also the retirement of Sally Mason. Pat Blank will be along as well to talk about a new transition center for laid-off John Deere workers. But first, let's talk with Sarah Bowden, Iowa Public Radio reporter. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Ben.
We wanted to have you remind us of a few of the big stories in Iowa news that you covered this year. An avian flu, bird flu outbreak over the summer. It forced the depopulation of millions of chickens in Iowa. Tell us that story.
Yeah, so there's a virus, strain of avian flu called H5N2. The Department of Agriculture believes that it mutated from a strain of avian flu that came over from Asia through migratory birds, and it wiped out a lot of chickens and a lot of turkeys around the country, 48 million nationwide, about 31 million in Iowa alone. Iowa had the second most outbreaks, but the most birds depopulated due to the fact that chickens are kept in larger numbers than turkeys. It was devastating for the poultry industry here.
I wonder if we think we're out of the woods yet. I know we're still recovering in terms of getting that population back, right?
Right. Well, happily, there were no outbreaks this fall during the fall migration, but spring migration, some experts say, takes a little bit longer, so that leaves a wider window for outbreaks. So we are not out of the woods yet, and I spoke with Secretary Northey last week, 2 weeks ago, and he said that he's anticipating there will be future outbreaks, but hopefully the industry has learned a lot about biosecurity. So hopefully it won't be as devastating as we saw this spring.
In another story that you covered, Sarah, a former Iowa lawmaker, Henry Rahons, was accused of third-degree sexual assault against his wife, who had dementia. This happened in a retirement home.
That's right. So former state lawmaker Henry Rahons, his wife, she's passed but had dementia, and he was accused of having sex with her. It was unclear. The jury was unable to conclude whether or not he had had sex with her on the night in question. But the real question of the story was whether or not a woman with dementia is capable of consenting to sex. And there's lots of schools of thoughts here. Some people tend to treat people with dementia somewhat infantilize them. But there's a difference between someone with dementia in their 70s and 80s and a 16-year-old. And so can, depending on that person's cognitive state at that very moment, consent to sex? Because sex is a comforting thing, and it's a thing that husbands and wives enjoy. So, and it can be comforting to someone who's very confused and distressed, as dementia patients tend to be. So it brought a lot of moral and medical questions into a legal framework that were very complicated.
Mm-hmm. There was attention given to this from outside the state as well.
Yes.
Was there a precedent of any sort set here by these not guilty verdict?
Well, it was a district court ruling, so there wasn't a legal precedent. But at the same time, it raises a lot of questions that I hope lawmakers and medical professionals and people in geriatrics consider, because this was a really horrible situation for this family. After the mother/wife died, this family, it was a blended family, stepdaughter, stepfather, were really at odds with each other. And, you know, the dying process can be so complicated in of itself, but to bring in these questions, it seems that there are a lot of things that could have been done to prevent a legal trial, a rape trial of a late mother. So hopefully that Iowans will learn from this and learn to talk to their parents and make it a more inclusive process about deciding when someone can and cannot consent to sexual relations.
Another case that you covered, Sarah, was the Iowa Supreme Court's ruling this year that telemedicine abortions in Iowa are allowed. How did the high court come to have this case?
Well, the Iowa Board of Medicine, which is made up of Branstad appointees, decided that telemed abortions are not a safe way to perform abortion. So they issued a set of rulings that essentially made telemed abortion illegal in the state. Planned Parenthood appealed, and it made its way to the Iowa Supreme Court. So it's worth noting that in Iowa, only physicians could perform abortions. Now, generally the medical establishment says this isn't necessary, especially when it comes to medical abortions, which telemed abortions are medical abortions, meaning an abortion performed with a pill. So a woman takes a pill and she miscarries. So there was, it went up to the Iowa Supreme Court, and the Iowa Supreme Court essentially decided that the Iowa Board of Medicine was holding telemed abortions to a higher standard than other telemedicine procedures, and as a result, telemed abortions are here to stay, at least for the time being, unless, I mean, something new could always happen. For example, the legislature could make a law, but telemed abortions for the time being are here to stay.
Mm-hmm. And the significance of this ruling, because I know Iowa is one of the few states that allows telemedicine abortions.
Yeah, except for I believe there's just one pilot program in Minnesota. Iowa is the only state in the nation with telemedicine abortion, with a telemedicine abortion system. In fact, some states outlaw telemed abortions. So, and it's also worth noting that Iowa is one of the few states to have expanded abortion access in the past decade. And even though Iowa has expanded its abortion access, the number of abortions in Iowa have declined. So just because women have more access to abortion doesn't mean that women are going to get more abortions.
Okay. Sarah Bowden, Iowa Public Radio reporter, thank you for reminding us of three of the bigger stories that you covered this year. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A survey of some of the top Iowa news stories in 2015, as told to us by Iowa Public Radio reporters and correspondents. Now joined by Pat Blank, Iowa Public Radio's All Things Considered host, of course, and also out there in the field reporting. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Ben.
Tell us about the John Deere layoffs. We had a number of layoffs and also a transition center for the laid-off workers.
That's right. There were 1,300 or so Deere & Company workers in Waterloo and Ankeny who got the news back in August that they were being laid off because of slow equipment sales, farm equipment sales, and just the whole farm economy has just kind of come to a grinding halt. And a transition center was opened at Hawkeye Community College in Waterloo to help them if they decide they aren't going to go back. Help them find something else to do with their skills without having to leave the community.
And, Pat, you talked with some of the workers who were laid off about what they see in the future.
I did, and I also talked to the vice president of the Union Local 838, UAW, Mike Oberhauser, and he says, you know, it's great to have a brand new transition center, but it doesn't do any good at all if those who really need it are too proud to ask for help.
I know exactly what the heartache feels like, and to go home and try to keep your pride. That, to me, that's a very big thing, keeping your pride. It's really tough when you don't have any money and, you know, the future does look bleak for you.
In fact, we just heard the news last week that Deere & Company laid off 54 more people, right?
That's right. Mm-hmm. So it looked like things were turning around a bit, and just as it looked as if the economy might be turning a corner, then the news of another layoff. And it wasn't just in the Waterloo area. It was also 220 in the Quad Cities area as well. So it looks like it's going to be well into the new year before any of this turns around.
Another story you covered, Pat, called Home Base Iowa. This is the governor's program that is aimed at helping returning vets find jobs. Tell us about that.
It's a very extensive program. It goes into education. It goes into finding jobs. It goes into helping with property taxes and making sure that the veterans get what they need as far as medical help as well. And it's very extensive. The other thing that it is doing that it hasn't done before is to forgive income taxes on the federal level and also for Iowa income taxes. So that's something that the veterans have been asking for a long time because they've seen that from other states, and they kept wondering why Iowa hadn't done that.
Mm-hmm. Also, Pat, a very interesting story that you covered that really speaks to Iowa's diversity. A new program launched this year aimed at helping non-native English speakers eat healthy. Take a moment to listen to a little bit of your report on the veggie vendors.
It began as a class of honor students, a team of 10 students who researched it throughout two semesters last year, and now we are putting it into practice.
And putting it into practice means traveling to a nearby farm to harvest the crops as they mature. One of those doing the picking is UNI student Natalie Rourke. She says although they've been at this just 2 weeks, lessons are being learned.
We have a sheet where we write down what we got of each thing, and then we look at like how long it took us. Like last week, we got way too many radishes. We really just don't know yet. So last week, we needed more onions. We're going to pick more onions today.
Helping guide the students is farmer Mark Latour, who points out that with good management, the produce stand should provide a good variety for the next several weeks.
Peppers, zucchini, and cucumbers in July, tomatoes late July. By the end of August, we're harvesting winter squash and a new crop of turnips and radishes.
It takes nearly 2 hours to harvest, wash, and package the crop. And then it's Natalie Rourke's job to make the bins, boxes, and bags fit into the vehicle that will transport them to the market site.
It's going to be kind of a learning curve trying to figure out how to fit everything in here, but so we'll make it work. You can pack minivan pretty tight.
The students pay the farmers wholesale prices and then charge the same at the produce stand to keep the cost low. The neighborhoods where they sell were selected because that's where a lot of immigrant families live. It's estimated that Waterloo is home to 2,300 Burmese, 400 Congolese, 200 Liberians, 400 Marshall Islanders, and several thousand Latinos. When the market opened this week, it was a blustery, overcast day. A woman known as Liberata was one of the first in line. She's part of the Burmese community, and she says she's pleased that the produce stand offers a good variety.
The whole house, all the family members, they can eat. So it's very cheap. $1, they can prepare one dish. It's very good.
The mustard greens, turnips and onions, as well as strawberries, sell very quickly. One of the cashiers, student Sarah Fries, says she's rewarded each time she makes a transaction.
Now to finally be working for it this summer and to actually see it impacting the community and people coming to our stand and buying from it, and it's just amazing to see that the hard work does pay off.
That was a really nice story, Pat. I'm wondering what you like most about that story.
I like this story a lot because it has a lot of elements. It started in a University of Northern Iowa classroom. It went out to a vendor that was producing produce for local farmers markets. And then it also went to the community that you spoke about, people who have a little trouble with their income and also with the language. And it's set up in a neighborhood in Waterloo that doesn't get a lot of attention normally. But during these days, it's a really busy section of town.
Mm-hmm. So what is this? This is just making sure that in their own language, if they're not speaking English well, that they understand the health benefits of certain foods?
Exactly. It's called the Waterloo Mobile Produce Stand. And right now the produce is mobile, but what they want to do is plant some vegetables in this particular area where the produce stand is so that the people who live there can actually tend to the garden and they can actually see it from seed to its being harvested.
Okay, thank you very much, Pat Plank, Iowa Public Radio's All Things Considered host and correspondent. We appreciate your time, Pat.
Glad to be here.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We are winding up our quick survey of some of the top Iowa news stories of 2015 with Iowa Public Radio reporters and correspondents. Joining me now, Dean Borg, Iowa Public Radio correspondent. Hi, Dean.
Hello, Ben.
We want to focus on mainly one story with two chapters at least, perhaps a third to come in 2016, has to do with the University of Iowa president. Let's start with the retirement of Sally Mason, former president of the University of Iowa. She stepped down on August 1st of this year. Why did she step down?
Well, I think it was time that, in her mind, that she wanted to devote more time to family. She thought that her professional contributions, she had satisfied herself. She wanted to do something different, and I think she moved to the East Coast, as far as I know, on the seashore.
Okay. What will you remember most about her tenure?
Well, what I will remember most is, number one, rocky relationships with the regents. And not with the university, per se, the university faculty or anybody else, but I think above and beyond that is how she persevered as a new president in the disastrous floods of 2008. Mm-hmm. She had only been in office probably about 11 months when that hit.
Rocky relations, chiefly with the Board of Regents president, Bruce Rastetter. What was the basis of that problem?
Well, not only with Bruce Rastetter. Before that, I can remember Michael Gartner making a published comment, after he'd left the board, I believe, it was. But Michael Gartner, who had been president of the Regents, he made a comment about Sally Mason as, we've got a person down at the University of Iowa with on-the-job training right now as president. And so that indicated that she wasn't considered to be presidential material, at least in experience, when she took that office, at least by Michael Gartner. But then, as you say, later, there was a perception, I think, among the Regents that they just weren't getting the performance from Sally Mason that they were expecting. And Bruce Rastetter and Katie Mulholland, Bruce Rastetter being the president, Katie Mulholland the vice chair or president pro tem, called her into a public forum, that forum in the event that they were the only people there, not other Regents, but public in that television cameras were gathered all around. I was sitting at Sally Mason's right hand with Katie Mulholland right beside her and Bruce Rastetter at the table also, when they read just sort of a letter of indictment. And what this had been precipitated by was a little controversy, a misstatement that she'd made at the University of Iowa concerning sexual harassment, and it had published in the Daily Iowan. It resulted in protests at the university here, and the Regents were feeling that it was getting out of control, and they wanted to step in and show that they had some authority here. So they called Sally to the table, and I remember Katie Mulholland in reading this statement of indictment saying, Sally, we can't help you if you don't communicate. Mm. And President Mason took that and made some changes in the way that she communicates statewide and so on. And but even at the end, let me say that she did not attend the final Regents meeting. She sent another person in her place. And traditionally, that last meeting for an outgoing person is a farewell.
A celebration and a thank you.
Yes. She boycotted that. She didn't do it publicly. She didn't say anything, but it was noticed.
The hiring of Sally Mason's replacement at the University of Iowa set another major story in motion this year. The Board of Regents hired Bruce Harold, a businessman with no university experience in university administration, to head the University of Iowa. Tell us a little bit about the controversy over the decision to put him at the top of the University of
Iowa. Well, it really goes back to how the Regents advertised how they were going to handle this search. There was a letter of points of how this is going to be handled, how we're going to select the interviewing committee and who it will be comprised of. And so everyone thought, boy, this is going to be the way it goes. But as the search evolved, and even after the appointment of President Harold, there were some indications that it wasn't exactly followed that way, Ben.
Mm-hmm. And faculty at the University of Iowa, very, very upset. Here's a little bit of audio. This is Kembrew McLeod. Were you at this event?
Well, this was what we're going to hear here was a public forum. Each of the candidates for president were brought in and met in a public forum along with other events that day on the university campus. This was a public forum where now President Bruce Harold was meeting the faculty and other members of the community in just a question and answer forum, and it turned out to be just a ridicule of Bruce Harold.
Quick follow-up. Are you a performance artist?
Why?
Just kidding.
No. Why do you ask the question? Because I missed the context.
Oh, I was just wondering if you were putting us on. Okay.
Okay, there we hear University of Iowa Professor of Communication Studies Kembrew McLeod. Again, that's before Bruce Harold became president, when the faculty was meeting the individual candidates there. So the story goes on. The American Association of University Professors investigated this, releasing a blistering report, concluding that the process, Dean, that you just described, that the Board of Regents used, in the words of the report, it gave only an illusion of an open, honest search. And I had Michael DeCesar, one of the AAUP investigators, on my program here. He called it a sham.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have to remember this is a prestigious organization in its title and in its conduct, but also it is a union. It's a labor union of faculty where they are organized throughout the United States. The University of Iowa doesn't have organized faculty. UNI does. But you have to take that into context. But I was also surprised in the AAUP's evaluation after investigation and the report, they said these are the things that were done wrong. It was largely an indictment of the way that the Board of Regents handled the search. But they said, we recommend that Bruce Harreld be given a chance to prove himself and take him at his word that he is willing to involve faculty in shared governance, it's called. And so we'll wait and see.
Okay. Can we predict anything in 2016? Will the legislature take this up, do you think?
I don't think the legislature will. I think it's yet to be seen how it will play out in the legislature. I think throughout Iowa, there's generally not the intensity of feeling, anti-Bruce Harreld feeling, that there is on the university campus among some of the faculty on the campus. But in the legislature, I think, in the words of the AAUP's report, they're willing to give him a chance to prove himself.
Okay, thank you very much, Dean Borg, Iowa Public Radio correspondent. And that wraps up our look at some of the top Iowa news stories of 2015. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. If you want to hear a podcast of this program or any of our other prior talk shows, go to iowapublicradio.org. You'll find podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River and Talk of Iowa. Our theme music is written and performed by the River Monks. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. You can contact us anytime. Here's our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.